Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Terry Hutchinson. I'm here with Dan Peterson and John Gee on Interpreter Radio, and we'll get their microphones on here.
Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Gentlemen, we've got, I think Kevin Christensen wants to come on with us at some point on the phone, and we'll get him on in a minute by phone, but first of all, just want to welcome you all to our weekly Interpreter Radio show, sponsored by the Interpreter Foundation. And just a reminder for you, it's a nonprofit organization. Everyone, with a couple of minor exceptions, like for clerical staff or something, is an unpaid volunteer.
Yep.
Isn't that right, Dan?
Yeah, that's right.
And one of the functions and the main achievement of Interpreter since its inception in 2012 is a weekly article, at least one, sometimes more.
Yeah.
And they're available for free online at MormonInterpreter.com, I think it is.
Yeah. Actually, I've got it bookmarked, so I don't remember. I need to check.
And, you know, this week they had a formal review of Thomas Wayman's New Testament Study Bible,
mm-hmm.
aimed at the audience of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's, all of us in radio are getting a little used to the new nomenclature. But anyway, that's out. I've seen it in stores. I've seen people with it. In fact,
yeah.
Our predecessor, Van Hale, just left the studio with his copy. I saw he was talking about it.
I just picked one up, but I haven't had a chance to look at it except mm-hmm. to browse for 30 seconds.
John and I talked about it when we were here a month ago.
I've only seen a copy of it. It was in the author's hands. Does that count?
Maybe so. I don't know. But, you know, a little later this evening, in fact, after our first break, we're going to interview Julie M. Smith, who is the author of the forthcoming volume in the BYU New Testament Commentary Series on Mark. It's the fourth published volume. The first one was Revelation by
Richard Draper
and Michael Rhodes.
Yes.
I shouldn't get those two mixed up, but I always do. And then the second volume was by S. Kent Brown, and it's on Luke. And then Draper and Rhodes wrote another on 1 Corinthians, and now we have Julie M. Smith for Mark. And I understand that Draper and Rhodes are now writing a Hebrews, and that probably is the next one in production. And
There are a number of authors working on individual commentaries.
Yes.
I should remember more of these.
Well, I know Jack Welch is doing Matthew,
right.
And Eric Huntsman is doing John, and John Gee himself, the one that's sitting here, is doing James.
Sometime.
At some point. But I just thought it was interesting. We have a Draper Rhodes, then we have a non-Draper Rhodes, then we have a Draper Rhodes and a non-Draper Rhodes. It's a little bit of a pattern.
Yeah.
Does that mean they're doing half of them?
Well, the advantage that they have is that there are two of them. They're both retired and may have more time available than some of the others. But Julie Smith's work on Mark is impressive.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about that, but without the index, it is almost 1,000 pages. And I've been a big proponent of this project for years because one thing I really like about it is its affordability. It is a great introduction for a regular reader to introduce themselves to some of the top scholarship in the references and the footnotes in the bibliography and in the way the material is approached. And they're $30 in hardback. They're $12 for an electronic version. You almost can't beat that price.
No, you really can't.
Because the normal, I mean, the normal, the Anchor Bible volumes or some of the others, the Hermeneas, mm-hmm. they're up in the $80 to $100 range. The Brill volumes get more than that. It's just really impressive, mm-hmm. and the fact that it is so affordable, it'll be great, especially with the church focusing on the New Testament.
One of the things that I'm excited about too is I remember years ago we used to go when I was with the old Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, or the Maxwell Institute as it became known. We would put on a display at the annual American Academy of Religion Society of Biblical Literature joint meeting, and we'd try to put out our best academic looking work and so on for people to look at, but I occasionally heard complaints or criticisms or questions about, well, don't you do anything on the Bible? And we had been focusing, since other people were doing the Bible, we had been focusing largely on the Book of Mormon and particularly Latter-day Saint subjects. But I thought, okay, we're maybe giving the wrong impression that we don't actually care about the Bible. And so I think this rectifies that problem a bit. This is a demonstration of a serious Latter-day Saint commitment to the Bible and to the study of the Bible. So,
yeah, there was a podcast, or not a podcast, there was a blog post from Benjamin Spackman.
Mm-hmm.
I think, Dan, you've got a similar post on Patheos,
yeah.
or however you say that.
Yeah.
And he was talking about Julie's book.
Mm-hmm.
And he said at some point he recommends the HarperCollins Study Bible to mm-hmm. people. And I've got that. I've got Oxford, the Jewish Study Bible. There's formats. I guess Thomas Wayman's New Testament is a little bit of a similar kind of format, although not as detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And he said somebody for the church needs to do one of these for an LDS audience, mm-hmm. using maybe the NRSV or something like that. Is anybody aware of a project like that?
I am aware of a project. But I am also aware that there's some internal dynamics and that it's not going as smoothly as some of the originators had hoped.
Things usually don't.
Yeah, well, It's not that there isn't the desire to produce something or the efforts to produce something, but if you look at the number of scholars that we have in the church and the number of worthwhile projects that they're involved in, some of them are spread a little thin.
Yeah.
And that sometimes makes it difficult to get out the material that ought to get out. One thing that we can't say... I can say is a project coming out. This will be, as far as I know, it will be a joint publication between the Religious Studies Center at BYU and Deseret Book is a volume scheduled to appear around April of background material on the New Testament.
Oh.
And so it will cover a wide variety of topics. It's not necessarily organized around the church's curriculum,
mm-hmm.
but it's background materials organized by subject. So there's there are articles on economics, on dress, on the atonement. There are about 30 or 40 different categories of.
So it won't be like the big one, the Jesus and the World of the New Testament, mm-hmm. that I recommend all the time for
that's
people.
That's a great resource, but this one will be individual articles mm-hmm. on different aspects of the New Testament, and hopefully making the scholarship available to a general audience.
So... It's going to be a little bit more technical then.
No, not it should be accessible, mm-hmm. but it should have the technical details. I'm horribly biased because I wrote the one on economics, but it's going to have, which is probably the worst as far as apparatus goes. My guess is I've got the most footnotes, but it will. It covers those and tries to relate it to the study of the Bible. economics can be a really boring topic, but I don't think in this case it necessarily
Careful, that's
is.
My degree.
The dismal science.
Well, I think we can get away with this because Dan and I, many years ago, wrote an article on the social and economic history of the olive.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we called it graft and corruption.
So, which I know is at least still being read.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan, you're with us tonight for the first time and as director of the Interpreter Foundation. What do we have to look forward to in 2019?
Well, more articles. I mean, we expect that we'll keep up the pace. This past year, we will have produced, by the end of the year, I think it's 57 distinct articles by 46 distinct authors. I expect the pace will be somewhat similar next year. No reason to believe it'll break. We're actually in the process of raising some additional funds, so I'm hoping we'll be able to expand and do some things we haven't done recently. We haven't done a conference, a major conference, in a long time. We did a small temples conference
last month,
mm-hmm. and we need to get the proceedings of that out to get it in published form. But we want to convene a couple of other conferences. That temples conference happens every other year. So we won't have one of those next year, but we're looking at some other conference ideas and getting some books out.
Now, you did one on sciences a few years
ago. We
did. You're going to follow up on that?
I'd like to do another. And my particular idea for it is I would like to get a conference on science and religion that is, if we can get the funding for it and so on, that would not be so much about trying to reconcile science and religion. That's done a lot, and it's an interesting topic. But I actually want to get some scientists to speak about science as itself a religious experience for them. And I've talked to some mm-hmm. active Latter-day Saint scientists who say, I would love to talk about that. That for me, you know, discovering something about the cell or the complexity of stellar evolution or something is sort of peeking into the mind of the Creator. It's an actual spiritual experience. It's not separate from or even at war with my testimony. It's actually a part of my testimony, that the grandeur of the universe and so on thrills me, and I want to convey something of that to an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Not science versus religion, but science as, in a way, a kind of religious enterprise for someone who's so motivated.
So we've been raising funds for a movie.
Yeah.
About the three witnesses.
Yes.
How's that coming?
Well, that's coming pretty well. And if there's anybody out there, though, with some big funds, or even small funds, we'd appreciate it. We need to raise a certain amount of money by, I don't know, about April 1st or sometime in March, in order to be able to commit to do what we call distant filming. That is to take a crew back to Palmyra, to Ohio, to Missouri to film on site. We've already begun doing interviews. We've got almost 10 scholarly interviews done, but they can be done anywhere at a very low cost. You just set up in a house somewhere, a studio, and interview somebody. It doesn't matter what the weather is. But you only have a window, maybe in the spring, possibly in the fall, to film in some of those other places.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's too crowded, it's too hot, you know, or it's snowing, too cold at certain seasons. So it's either this spring or it's the following spring. Maybe we could do it in the fall. But
mm-hmm.
So we have a bit of a deadline that we're working under. We don't have to have the entire cost of the film in, which is about $1.25 million, but something like $350,000. Mm-hmm. We have some of that in hand, actually. But we still have a distance to go. And that's the idea is not merely to produce a film, but there would be a film and there would be spin-off products, what we call snippets. You know, interview portions, 3 minutes, and so on, that would be used on computer online and so on. So, a lot of exciting things to do. So, if anybody out there wants to give $50,000 or $100,000, $10,000,
or $5,
we would love to have it. It's that time of the year, you know, end of the year. The
and
IRS
it's all
watching.
Tax deductible, by the way. We're a 503 corporation.
That's right.
Thank you. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson with Interpreter Radio. Wow, not quite what we normally have, but we're working on that. Right, Dan?
Oh, that bumper music is great.
The bumper music is great. Exactly.
More like Black Sabbath.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we've got... Is that who that was?
I don't even know.
I was going to say. Maybe one of our callers can let us know. Good evening, Julie and Kevin. We can hear you just fine. Thank you. Hang on one second, and we'll see if we can bring Kevin online. There you go. Kevin, is that you?
Kevin is here.
Okay, Kevin and Julie. Kevin Christensen is with us now, one of our regular hosts here on Interpreter Radio, and our special guest is Julie M. Smith. Julie, we've been talking a little bit about you off the air. Maybe your nose was itching, but you have... just about got published. I guess it's at press right now. The new volume in the BYU New Testament Commentary Series on Mark. And
that is correct.
That's quite an achievement. So let's begin, and we talked a little bit before, but I'd like to have you bring our listeners up to speed. This is your first interview regarding this book that I know is coming out, and I know it won't be the last. But how long have you been working on this project, and how did you get involved in the first place?
Well, that's sort of a long answer. I'm not sure whether to say 4 to 5 years or whether to say my whole adult life, which is a lot longer than 4 to 5 years. In a concentrated way, I started working on it about 4 to 5 years ago when I was invited to contribute to the commentary series. But I have been studying the Gospel of Mark since I did a graduate degree in biblical studies in the mid-90s.
And what attracted you to Mark? I know you talk a little bit about it in the book.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Mark is the gem hidden in plain sight. It's right there in everybody's copy of the Scriptures, but we tend not to read it. Or if we read it, we read it through the lens of how Matthew and Luke read it. We don't read it on its own terms. And I just find it fascinating in terms of some of the ways that it differs from Matthew and Luke's presentation of the story of Jesus' life, and well, well worth the study.
Now, when this series came out several years ago, the introduction talked about how each individual author would have some leeway and some freedom to write the commentary the way they wanted to. And I'm going to tell our listeners right now that yours is a bit unique. As we were reading about it in the introduction, and my co-host tonight, John Gee, had read the introduction, and he said to me, "Hey, we'd like to ask Julie about some of these things." So, John, what was it that caught your attention in the introduction that we want to ask Julie about?
Well, part of it is that Julie, you mentioned that you're not going to talk about certain topics, and you are going to talk about other topics. So, well, let's talk about the ones that you are going to talk about. You say that you're going to talk about textual variants and translation issues, basic cultural knowledge, biblical allusions, literary interpretations, and then non-androcentric interpretation, which might need to get a little unpacked for the listener. But... tell us about the basic cultural knowledge, because I think a lot of us feel like we have some sort of handle on what the biblical world is like, but are we fooling ourselves when we think that?
That is a great question. To an extent, I think we're all fooling ourselves because none of us know as much as any person on the street would have known 2,000 years ago, right? No matter how much we study, we just only have access to the tip of the iceberg, right, of the knowledge of the ancient world. But having said that, I do think there are things that sometimes might be lost to modern readers if they aren't as familiar with the culture. And so I think that can be helpful. So just for one example, when we come to teachings on divorce, those can't be contextualized against what we do in the 21st century. They have to be contextualized against how divorce functioned, and particularly the impact it would have had on a woman or a child's life 20 centuries ago, which would be very different. Another example, and this one is probably a little more familiar, especially to some of the listeners for a show like this, is if you don't know that a mustard seed is paradigmatic for what they believe to be the smallest object, then you're missing, you know, a little bit of the richness there when Jesus talks about faith being as a mustard seed. So just little things like that, I think, can be kind of helpful in fleshing out what's happening in a text. And I think the real danger is thinking that you know what is to be known when there might be some gaps that some scholarship could fill in and maybe help, again, provide a richer view of the text than would otherwise be there.
Thank you. I'd also like to ask you a little bit about, you mentioned focusing on textual variants, and of course the Gospel of Mark has perhaps the largest textual variant of all of the New Testament, and as well as many minor ones. What challenges did you face dealing with those?
Well, just trying to bridge the gap. The book is written for a general reader, so I'm not assuming that the reader knows Greek or that the reader has looked closely at these texts before. So trying to summarize all the data and make it intelligible to someone who doesn't have the background, you know, in a concise way and in a meaningful way. And then also not getting bogged down in minutia, because there are some textual variants that just frankly don't make a whole lot of difference, so we don't want to devote too much time to those. So, you know, trying to present the information in a concise and useful and meaningful way was a little bit of a challenge from time to time. I assume you're talking about the ending of Mark there, right, with the biggest textual variant.
Well, if he didn't, I was going to. but seriously, let me take a step back for a second, Julie. What is the main question that you're addressing in this book? Because when you talk about it in the introduction, before you set out the areas that you do intend to cover that John was just asking you about, there are several major areas that you say, this isn't this and this isn't that.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason
right.
is because those questions don't appear to address the main point you want to make. What was that?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. One thing I'm worried about is that people are going to see that this book would make a really excellent doorstop because it's so large and think that it tries to do everything or would tell you everything you might ever want to know about the Gospel of Mark. But that's not true. It's actually a very, very narrow commentary, and I really just tried to poke at one question. And that one question is, how would Mark's first audiences have understood this text? And that's it. And that leaves a lot of other really interesting and really worthwhile questions completely to the side. So I'm not looking at how was this understood in the Middle Ages, how was this understood in the early modern period, how was it understood in the 19th century, how was it understood around the world today. I'm not looking at any of those questions. I'm also not looking specifically at devotional questions. I hope the audience will do that themselves, but I figured that that's where they'd probably need the least hand-holding from me. Members of the church are usually relatively proficient in making that leap, right? We did a lot of practice with that, so I didn't spend time on that, even though I think it's important. What I did spend time on, what I just tried to focus on, was that one question of how would Mark's first audiences have understood the text? So it's really quite narrow in that way.
And one of the things you mentioned in the introduction is that you don't cite, unlike some of the other volumes in the series, you don't cite a lot of modern LDS authorities.
I don't. And again, that's a time and space issue and a question of what I think the audience can do on their own. So this is not me saying those things are not important, but it's just the recognition that if that's the commentary you want, and I would hope the audience would want it, but if that's the commentary you want, you have very easy access to that. When I have opportunities to talk to various groups about scripture studies, one of the things I talk about a lot is using the General Conference Scripture Citation Index. So if you want to know what church leaders have said about Mark, you have easy access to that. I don't need to do that part. Instead, what I'm trying to provide is the part that most members of the church don't have easy access to, which is the materials that help us understand this question of what would it have meant to Mark's first audiences. So So, no, this is not a commentary that has a lot of general authority quotations in it. Again, that's not me commenting on saying that's not important. It's just a recognition that the audience can easily find that information elsewhere, and I'm trying to cover different ground.
But you do make the point that this is aimed at LDS readers. How so?
Yes. Okay, because I'm trying to meet the reader where they are and expose them to some things they might not have seen before. So I'm assuming that they're pretty conversant with the King James Version, but not so conversant with the Greek text, with modern scholarship, or with modern English translations. So I'm assuming that the reader is an LDS reader and that that's where they're coming from, and then I'm helping flesh out some areas of research on Mark that they may not otherwise be familiar with.
Now, there is one exception to that, and that's your treatment of the Joseph Smith translation. And in your appendix in the back, you talk in one sense about how it tends to tie in some instances with Luke and Matthew, and then in some other instances it does not. There appears to be a case where when it isn't tying, it actually, Joseph Smith's translation of Matthew ties in with Mark rather than the other way around. Is it your opinion that Mark is older than Matthew in terms of the gospel itself?
Absolutely.
And that's kind of borne out in the way that that's handled in the Joseph Smith translation?
So, like you said, I do treat the Joseph Smith translation, but I do it in an appendix because, again, our question is, what would this have meant to Mark's first audience? And Mark's first audience does not have the Joseph Smith translation, right?
Right.
But I also recognize that LDS readers are going to be curious and interested in this question of, you know, what do I do with the Joseph Smith translation? What is it saying? What can it help me understand about the text? So I did want to include it. And another reason, frankly, that I wanted to include it was just because when I sat down and tried to grapple with what exactly is the question of what exactly is the Joseph Smith translation of Mark doing, I was just sort of fascinated by it. And so looking at it closely, I just wanted to share some of the things I found. And so I did handle that in an appendix to the book. So it's not something you're going to see throughout the commentary again because it doesn't directly address the main question, which is what it would have meant to the first audience. But I do deal with it in an appendix where I focus on this idea that it has certain impulses. Maybe another way to say that is that there's certain trends of what kind of changes the Joseph Smith translation makes. One thing I encounter frequently is that some church members aren't aware of the fact that the Joseph Smith translation is a lot more than just what we see in the footnotes and endnotes to the LDS edition of the scriptures. There are a lot of other variants.
Yeah, parts of the Joseph Smith translation that aren't included. They only used about a third, if I understand it right.
I don't know where the numbers are, particularly for Mark's, but there's a lot there more than what you would just see in the footnote to your scriptures. Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting things that I found when I looked at it more closely, and again, this is just for Mark, for the Joseph Smith translation, is that it amplifies what I call the unique tendencies of Mark. And part of the reason I find that interesting is for 2,000 years, the tendency for almost every reader of the four Gospels has been to blend them and harmonize them and combine them. And the Joseph Smith translation, for the most part, goes in the opposite direction. By amplifying Mark's unique tendencies. So I just found that very, very interesting because it's very, very counter to what virtually every reader of the canon has done for 2,000 years. So just really interesting to see that show up in the Joseph Smith translation.
That's kind of a natural impulse for all of us, though, isn't it? To just say, okay, we've got a story of Jesus. Let's make these stories all fit together.
That's what virtually every reader has done for 2,000 years, so that's one of the reasons I find it super interesting to see the Joseph Smith translation moving in exactly the opposite mm-hmm. direction for the most part.
So when we get back to it, we'll have a break here in a couple of minutes, but one last question before the break. One of the things that you talk about is non-androcentric interpretation. So John said we needed to unpack that a little bit. tell us what you mean by that in terms for the lay reader, such as myself. Well, I'm not quite a lay reader, as you know. Close.
So androcentric would mean male-focused, and non-androcentric means not male-focused. I didn't want to use the word feminist. I don't have a problem with using that term in other contexts or to describe myself in general. However, what I was trying to do here was not do a feminist reading per se, but to do a non-androcentric reading, which I see as something different. I didn't want to make it female-focused. I didn't want to try to import modern notions into the text. I didn't want to start with some commitments and read those into the text. What I wanted to do is say, what would this text look like if we didn't read it with a male focus? And part of the reason that's important is for about 2,000 years, almost all of the readers and interpreters and translators of Mark were in fact men. Not only that, for many, many centuries, there were men associated with monasteries. And so that provides a very distinctive lens for reading. And I think some of those reading habits carry over into the modern era. And I think it's useful to peel away some of those layers and try to read it through fresh eyes. To use one example, we have a centerpiece story in Mark that is about the experience of menstruation. It is extremely hard to imagine that this is a story that men are telling to other men. It seems instead like a
All right, Julie, we're going to interrupt you right now for a minute while we go to a break, and we'll catch it right after that. Thank you. This is Terry Hutchinson on Interpreter Radio. Let's see if that's... There we go. That's coming up. We also have Julie Smith and Kevin Christensen on the phone. Kevin, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here. I've been listening.
All right. Have you got any questions for Julie before we jump in with some more?
I just had a chance to be browsing at some of this. I think it's a very large book, but I don't think anyone should be intimidated by the size because, as I've been glancing at it, the writing is exceptionally clear, and it's very ambitious, and I think it's going to be a brilliant thing to have around, but... The writing and structure is exceedingly clear, so it will be a great resource for people, and I don't think they should be intimidated by the size, but just rejoice in the presence of a resource like this. I think it's very impressive.
Well, this is Dan Peterson here. I don't know how much the music drowned out what Julie was saying, but Julie, you were getting into a discussion of the story of the woman with the issue of blood that's well-known, and how that how a non-androcentric interpretation would treat that, and I think you just got sort of walked over by the music. So,
thank you for bringing us back to that. I just wanted to make the point that this is a story that would have particular resonance for female readers or female audience members who may have been listening to the first versions of Mark, and maybe not so much for male readers. And it's one that I think even to this day, maybe due to our own discomfort, sometimes we tend not to pay as much attention to. So basically what I'm trying to do with a non-androcentric approach is just to take a male focus away and think a little more deeply about how the earliest audiences would have understood the text.
It seems to me that you're taking also a similar approach to the disciples in Mark, because Mark tends to portray the disciples in a much more fallible and human form than the other Gospels do.
Yes, and this is one place where I think LDS readers may stumble a little bit. And so I think a helpful analogy here is a lot of LDS readers will be familiar with the story of when he would later be President Gordon B. Hinckley, but at this point he's a very young elder, Gordon Hinckley, and he's discouraged as a missionary. And he writes a letter to his dad, the gist of which is, this is hard, I'm not getting anything accomplished, this is frustrating, I'm wasting your money. And his dad tells him to get to work. Well, an LDS audience knows how to interpret that story. The moral of that story, right, is work hard as a missionary. The moral of the story is not, if you're frustrated, write a letter of complaint. Or you should be frustrated if you don't see the results you want. Right, we know how to interpret that story. I think sometimes though we get in a bit of trouble when we read the Gospels because we read someone like Peter as the president of the church. He's not the president of the church in the Gospels. He's a brand new elder. And even before that, right, he's a brand new disciple. So So we need to read him more like we would read a story of young Gordon Hinckley, as not the person he would be in the future. Someone who's definitely on that path and learning, but not someone who is doing everything right and understands everything. And I think sometimes we come to some skewed interpretations when we think maybe the disciples are doing everything right. In Mark, they're not. In Mark, they're learners. They make a lot of mistakes. It works well on a literary level because then Jesus gets to reteach them and thereby reteach the audience. So it works really well as a story by providing some repetition. You see this with the parables, right, where Jesus provides a parable. The disciples don't get it. They ask Jesus to explain it. Jesus explains it. So the audience gets to hear the explanation and the parable again. So it's very effective as a teaching tool for the audience. But you would not want to walk away from that story with the moral being that you should try hard not to understand parables because you want to be like the disciples, right? You want to see them as people who are still learning and making mistakes. And the other part of that coin is that when you see the disciples as really, really new at this and with a lot of questions and a lot of misunderstandings, you see another side of Jesus, which is that he is really, really patient. And I think that's important, too, and that's one of the things we lose if we think the disciples understand everything and do everything right, is we don't see that model of patient reteaching from Jesus again and again that comes through in Mark. So that's one of the themes I try to emphasize, is that the role of the disciples in Mark is maybe not what we think it is. I think particularly with some of the later Gospels, we lose some of those nuances of the disciples as learners who make a lot of mistakes, but it's really front and center in Mark.
So another thing that comes out in this commentary is you present different options to the reader, but
yes,
you never really settle on one or reveal to the reader what your opinion is about those choices. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So there are many, many instances in the book where there is a numbered list. And so what I'm doing there is I'm saying, you know, there are a lot of options for how you might want to interpret this, and I'm not going to pick one for you. And I intentionally did that because I didn't want to present a surety that I don't think the evidence supports. And so basically I left the heavy lifting to the audience to try to figure out what was going on in a story, and I didn't try to force a conclusion or demand a conclusion that I didn't think the evidence warranted. Now, there are a lot of instances in the book where I absolutely do draw conclusions and adopt interpretations, but there's a lot where I just sort of leave it be. So one example of that is when we have the dove at Jesus' baptism, where the way it's in Mark is the Spirit like a dove descending upon him, is the King James language. I have a list of maybe a dozen possibilities for what that means to say that the Spirit is descending like a dove, because it's just not really clear what Mark means by that. It may have been clear to the original audience, but we don't have all that information. And so I go through a list of possibilities, and I don't really draw a conclusion because I don't think the evidence is there for me to feel really comfortable in drawing a very strong conclusion. So I just sort of present some options and leave it to the reader.
Now, you quote Elder Oaks in saying that this is a valid approach for a commentary, at least. He talks about how sometimes you just have to follow the Spirit.
Right, and that's really one of my hopes, and I think, you know, this idea of this example I gave about the dove is a really good one, in the sense that I think different readers or at different points in their lives might be drawn to different resonances of what's happening there, and I think that's a process the Spirit can guide them through towards finding what they need from the text at the moment.
So there's a place a little later, and in fact early on when Mark talks about John the Baptist, there are some pretty obvious parallels to Elijah.
Mm-hmm.
And then you bring that up again at the Transfiguration. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of wondering what your opinion is about that.
What do you mean exactly?
Well, there are a lot of similarities to Mark's text, and this is a quote from the book, including a reference to Elijah, an encounter with God on a mountain, and a symbolically significant cloud. At the end of the story, the Lord energized Elijah with power. You cite Kings with regard to that, but I think it's the NET, the New English Translation. If the allusion is intentional, it would encourage Mark's audience to read the Transfiguration as an endowment experience for Jesus, or as Jesus, in your words exactly, being endowed with power from on high. And then you give us one of these lists. So, you know, it talks about whether Jesus' experience on the Transfiguration constituted something akin to the modern LDS practice of receiving a temple endowment, and you give us a list. Is that another similar instance to the dove that you were talking about here?
Right, and I know some LDS readers have made moves in seeing the Transfiguration in that way, and so I mention it as a possibility. There's also another section in that chapter where I talk specifically about the Transfiguration in Restoration Thought, and that is a little bit unusual for the commentary, again, that I'm breaking a little bit beyond how Mark's first audiences would have read it, but again, it's because I'm trying to meet the audience where they are, which is that I know that a lot of LDS readers are really interested in what exactly is going on with the Transfiguration and what parallels might it have to practice today and that sort of thing. So I do, in that section, though, provide another list to try to work through it. And then I also, in addition to doing that, also provide some cautions that there are some ways where it doesn't overlap really well with the modern LDS endowment. So I try to take the approach in the commentary of more laying out evidence and laying out options as opposed to drawing conclusions on everything.
Mm-hmm. I found that that was very helpful, those lists. They were very detailed, and at least for me, it painted a picture, and then I was able to draw my own conclusions from it. But I did like the fact that when you pointed out that if this is intentional to kind of bring Elijah into it, that it would have been interpreted by Mark's original audience as being some kind of an endowment to Jesus, or a bestowal of power, if you would.
Yeah, and I would just want to be really careful with the word endowment, which signifies a lot to LDS readers. I don't know that Mark's original audience is thinking exactly in those terms, particularly as a technical term, but they may very well have gotten the nuance of a bestowal of power from that story.
So now that you're just about at press, we're hoping we'll see this before Christmas, but if not, soon thereafter. It's going to be used, you know, in a lot of places for the upcoming Come Follow Me and for the New Testament study this year. What was the thing that struck you the most when you had completed this project?
Oh, that is a tough question. The thing that struck me the most when I'd completed the project, I think it's really hard for me to settle on one thing. I think if I had to point to one thing, it would just be how fresh it feels, in the sense that the text is grappling with the same kinds of issues and questions we are dealing with 2,000 years later. Everything from how we interact with governments to how we interact with each other, to how we deal with boundary cases, to what it means to follow Jesus, it just doesn't feel dated.
And how did it impact you personally in terms of your understanding of Jesus and the Gospels?
I really like the Jesus in Mark. That might sound like a funny thing to say, and I realize it is on some level. I've already commented on his patience, which is a virtue that I could definitely stand to develop a little bit more of. But he's also, he's wise. He wins debates against religious leaders, but he also has little kids. He's well-rounded. And that might sound like faint praise, but I think we already, you know, we know the outlines of the story. It wasn't a surprise to me to find out that he's the Son of God in Mark. That we already know, right? But what maybe is surprising are these little nuances, the way that Mark presents this complete portrayal of him as someone with very, very human elements, someone who's willing to say, I don't know the time it is when the Son of Man will return to someone with these exalted elements, right, like the transfiguration, which we were just talking about. And then again, this picture of someone who can best religious leaders in a debate, but someone who also spends time hugging little children. It's just this very, very complete portrait. And that's something that really stuck out to me in the details of Mark.
So now that you've got the book at press, are you still finding things that you wish you could put in?
yeah, to an extent, right? And it is hard. You just feel like you're never done. In fact, one of the hardest parts of writing it to me was I just wanted to spend all my time researching and never write, and I eventually just had to enact really strict discipline about how much time I could devote to research, and then when that time was up, it's like, sorry, I know there's 10 other things you want to read, but it's never going to get written if all you do is research. And there's always this trade-off, right, that it would have been great to spend another 20 years reading and thinking, but at some point you also need to get it published and be done with it and move on to other things as well. So it's always a trade-off.
All right. Well, this is quite an accomplishment, Julie. Thanks for being with us tonight. That's Julie M. Smith, the author of the new Mark commentary. We'll be right back after the news break to take some of your calls as well as continue our conversation here on Interpreter Radio.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, at last. We got it right. This is Terry Hepsinson sitting here in studio on Interpreter Radio with our director, Dan Peterson, one of the founders of Interpreter, as well as John Gee joining me in studio and Kevin Christensen joining us remotely. Good evening, Kevin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for waiting and being patient with us through our interview with Julie Smith. It's been a while since we've had you on the program, and I just have to confess this is the first time I've been on air with Kevin. And I just have to say that Kevin is the person who introduced me many years ago through his writings to Margaret Barker and some very interesting ways of viewing the Old Testament with his articles that he wrote for the then Farms Review and some other places. So, Kevin, thank you from me personally. Welcome to the program.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, it's always trippy to be able to just even think about having been a part of something like that. But, of course, it would have happened anyway, because I heard that after Noel Reynolds had been on a trip to the Vatican doing something, you know, for BYU in the Vatican Library, and he read Margaret Barker's The Great Angel, and he got very excited and went to the farm's offices, and he said, have you heard of Margaret Barker? And they said, oh, yeah, we just published Kevin's book. So... he got in touch with me, but one of the things that, and then he went and visited Margaret, you know, on her home, but one of the things he told me later was that my writing the book had saved him the trouble, so I always have the sense it was fun to be part of this thing, but it would have happened anyway.
You know, it did happen with me independently. This is Dan. I bought a copy of The Great Angel back at the National Meeting of the American Academy of Religion Society of Biblical Literature, because there's always, the thing that I really went to those for was what Bill Hamlin and I called the Bookanalia.
I remember reading about that. Yeah.
Where, you know, the books are 75% off, 90% off in some cases. You go on the last or the very last day, and it's just amazing. Well, there was a copy of The Great Angel sitting there at the Oxford, I think it was Oxford, I don't remember.
It would have been SCPK.
Yeah, it might have been SCPK. And anyway, it was just sitting there, and I thought, oh, this looks interesting. I bought it. I brought it home along with a stack of probably 100 other books. And one night, I was sitting in my office, and it was just kind of pulsing, glowing there on the shelf. It was just like... look at me, look at me. And I began reading it. I'd never heard of it before. I knew nothing about her. And as I read it, I began thinking, this woman has got to be LDS. And then I think, no, she's not. That gives it away. She's not. Then I'd read a little more and think, yes, she is. Yeah, because there are some things of it that were so consonant with the way we view Scripture, the way we think about theology. It just blew me away. And but I can't claim any great, you know, achievement in discovering her. It was just pretty much on my part, as far as I know, sheer chance or divine guidance.
Well, she's been growing in the literature, I've noticed, yeah. Because I've been doing a lot of research on ancient temples for a project that I've been working on with my father-in-law. And it is more common in the bibliographies now to see Margaret Barker yeah. cited, to see Michael Morales cited, to mm-hmm. see Donald Perry cited, and James Lundquist, as well as Margaret Barker and Crispin Fletcher Lewis, mm-hmm. who also is just fascinating on those kind of things to me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, in a talk that was given at BYU just recently, about a month ago tomorrow, I think, by Elder Jeffrey Holland, gave the 2018 Neil A. Maxwell lecture, and one of the things he suggested was that Latter-day Saints who want to be involved in scholarship and talk with other scholars beyond the church, there's some themes we might take up, and one of them that he mentioned specifically was the idea of sacred space. You know, essentially mm-hmm. temples, and we already have done quite a bit on that.
Well, it was quite interesting because that was in the evening, and the entire day we had been interpreter and BYU Studies and Department of Asian Near Eastern Languages sponsoring a conference on temples at BYU. So it was rather nice to have an apostolic seal of approval on that topic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're really, really interested in temple studies, and
yeah.
part of the problem has been developing a way to do it, because as Latter-day Saints, we can't really talk about some of the things in the temple, but we have discovered you can talk indirectly about them. You can point to ancient things, and some people will say, oh, that's very interesting, and others in the audience will say, whoa, that is really interesting. And you don't have to say anything overtly.
They'll get it. The late James Robinson, who does the Nag Hammadi,
yeah.
he used just to do presentations about the Gospel of Philip, and I think it's Gay Strathern,
yeah.
who pointed out that he often would have LDS people in his audience come up and comment about the mirrored bridal chamber, which
yeah.
When you really get into the nuts and bolts of it is not related to the temple in that way,
right?
But it's just something that always creeps up. I went to the and I think you spoke there, Dan, a conference up at Utah State several years ago.
Right.
Margaret Barker was there,
yeah,
and they had a Catholic scholar there. I can't remember his name, but he said he enjoyed speaking to audiences with a lot of Latter-day Saints because when he talked about Melchizedek, they would have an idea of who
right.
he was talking about.
Right. Well, I remember even, you know, I'm old enough now that I remember such things as when Klaus Baer came out to BYU for Hugh Nibley's retirement, and he gave, I think, two lectures maybe on the ancient Egyptian temple, and he was just floored because he packed the hall, and he said, you know, normally when he would speak on a topic like that, there'd be six people. Because no one cared. But you mentioned ancient Egyptian temples, and the Mormons just
yeah.
flock.
No, you mean the members of the Restored
Excuse
Church.
Me. Members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they were that back then.
Yeah, they were Mormons at the time, so they're not anymore.
It's interesting because I've been to some of these conferences where Egyptologists talk about ancient Egyptian temples, and yes, they're usually 20 at most in
yeah.
the audience. It's really not unusual to have that that sort of turnout. But then most Egyptological conferences tend to be rather small anyway.
Well, and they're also in obscure places. They're
like
not
Warsaw.
They're not in places where most people can go.
Right.
Well, the one I went to was in Warsaw, but they've been in places like Warsaw and London, you know, small places like that.
Well, I have to tell you a story about one conference I went to years ago, the American Research Center in Egypt. And they had decided that they wanted to branch out a little bit. It was all Egyptologists. And so they said, you know, let's bring in a medievalist to talk about medieval Egypt. So they invited me. And Bill Hamblin, I guess, was responsible for that in a way. So there I am, supposedly giving my paper at a meeting in Memphis, Tennessee. You know, Memphis, ancient Egypt, there's a connection there. But But anyhow, I mean, nobody came. Nobody came to my session. They'd invited me, but none of them were actually interested in what I had to say. So the conference, that session, was me, Bill Hamlin, who'd invited me, and the chair of the session. And we finally said, to heck with this, Bill and I went off to Graceland. And so I talked to him in the car about the paper. But meanwhile, the funny part was there must have been 60 or 70 Egyptologists in the room next door. We could hear them laughing and applauding. They were having a great time. It was a session on the reflexive Middle Egyptian verb. I mean, exciting stuff.
Well, Kevin's laughing and John is laughing.
It must have been made more exciting by the presenter.
That's right. Well, so, Kevin, what are the projects that you've got working on right now?
Well, I finished an essay that's going to be in the Midgley Fetch Drift that I wrote about 8 years ago. It's finally coming to pass, one called Notice and Value. And I also just finished up doing my footnotes for a review for the interpreter that's coming out.
Thank you.
Fairly shortly, I guess. I don't know which day it is, but actually I did a review of two books that came out through the Maxwell Institute on A Dream, A Rock, and A Pillar of Fire, and the one on Christ and Antichrist, because I had a particular interest in those and wanted to see what they had to say and found out I had something to say about it. And we'll see what happens when I get published, usually. I remember that Robert Heinlein, famous science fiction writer, said that publishing is like dropping feathers down a well. And most of the time, that's been the case for the things that I've published over the years.
Meaning you never know when they're actually going to hit.
Well, you never hear a splash.
Yeah, you don't. They don't make any splash.
The one major exception was when Paradigms Regained came out, and that made a splash.
The ripples
still
are
going
still
on.
Going on. Yeah.
I remember once back at a meeting of the Mormon History Association in Kirtland, and I was with Lou Midgley, I think. I can't remember who I was standing there with. And all of a sudden, some fellow came up, and he introduced himself and said that he really, really enjoyed what we were then editing, the Farms Review, or the review of books on the Book of Mormon. And we were so delighted to have found our reader. We'd always wondered who out there was reading this, and it turned out it was him.
I'm waving my hand.
Oh.
I was one of them, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, only rarely have I ever met anybody that's read any of my articles except people that I've handed them to, except a few years ago in Provo when they let me introduce Margaret when she talked. And then I had a bunch of people there that came up and told me that they'd been reading my stuff. That was eye-opening.
Well, I remember a colleague, long retired from BYU, who'd written a book published by, it was a fairly prestigious press, Princeton or somebody, on German literature during a certain era, I think the 1700s. And his book, which he had labored on for years, had sold, I think, 78 copies. That was it. He had boxes of them in his office.
Well, on my radio program, I do a daily book review down at St. George. And years ago, I ran across a book called The Cuckoo's Calling, and it was by an individual named Robert Galbraith. Now, Robert Galbraith sold 1,500 copies in hardcover in both the UK and the United States. And then, somehow word got out that Robert Galbraith, which everyone knew was a pseudonym, turned out to be J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter series, and it immediately went and sold 350,000 copies and is now a TV show, and she's on the fourth book with that, and it's actually a pretty good series for that kind of a genre, but it's I think there is a certain amount of just if you hit the wave at the right place or not, and who knows.
So, Kevin, you can thank me for this afterwards, but I think we can now announce on air that Kevin Christensen is a pseudonym for J.K. Rowling.
Oh, that would be nice.
There we go. Yeah. Living incognito in the East somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. Well, we do live incognito out here. It's been interesting. We've enjoyed it. Although, one of the things we did a few years ago was since we're in the East and can't go to a lot of the stuff in the West, we heard that Margaret was speaking to the Greek Orthodox Seminary in Yonkers, New York, on the Great High Priest. And so I thought, you know, we've met Margaret before and decided to go up and see her there. And we went, she recognized us and came to see my wife and I, and she, the first thing she said was that when she got there, she said, now the, if you're interested in the temple, the first thing that you're going to have to do is swallow your pride and ask the Mormons, because they have the best scholars on the topic.
Well.
Well, you mentioned that you have a review coming out, an interpreter. We have a few other things that are...
Yeah, that have been an interpreter recently. Dan, you wanna just tell us about a few of the articles that have been up? And then I think after the commercial break, what we can do is talk about some recommendations that you might make for Christmas, Kevin. Based on your interest and your knowledge, and we'll ask John the same thing, although we'll ask him to dumb it down for the rest of us, I guess.
Well, I hope we have time to get these in. I'm just going to mention them really quickly. Just some articles that have come out recently that people may not have heard about. The one that came out on Friday is one called Let There Be a Famine in the Land. It's a really interesting approach where a person is looking at the precipitation history of Mesoamerica as measured in stalagmites. This is a whole new cutting-edge kind of science. They're able to measure them very precisely. And he's able to show that a drought occurred in Mesoamerica at precisely the time that you have one talked about in Helaman 11, which seems to be a really nice bullseye for the Book of Mormon. That it talks about a major drought lasted about 3.5 years, and there seems to be a drought of about that characteristic, that length, maybe a little bit longer in some regions that occurred in Mesoamerica at that time. And so it's really kind of fun. I mean, it's a new approach to things that I at least had not thought of.
All right. Well, we'll catch up on the rest of it right after this brief message. Please stay tuned to the rest of us on Interpreter Radio. Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson sitting in here on Interpreter Radio this evening on K-Talk. And join us in a couple of days. We'll have this downloaded as a podcast and a little bit cleaned up and edited. We've got Dan Peterson, the chairman of the Interpreter Foundation, with us tonight, as well as John Gee, Egyptologist at BYU, among other things, author. And we've got Kevin Christensen, another author, on the phone with us. And this segment, we thought we would make some recommendations for some Christmas gifts about books that are either upcoming or books that are out. We interviewed Julie Smith in the last hour about her upcoming Mark volume for the BYU New Testament commentary. And so, Dan, we'll start with you.
Well, I noticed that Julie didn't commit to having that book out in time for Christmas.
She doesn't have any control over that.
No, no.
I'm on the phone with those people about every other day.
No, and you know, it could happen, but my bet is at this point it won't, which is too bad because it would be a nice gift. But well, I wanted to mention a couple of other articles first, then I'll talk about one book that I just finished. I mentioned Jim Hawker's article, Let There Be a Famine in the Land, which appeared in Interpreter in the Journal of Mormon Scripture, a soon-to-be-renamed journal. We haven't decided yet on what the new subtitle will be, but it won't be a Journal of Mormon Scripture much longer. But Let There Be a Famine in the Land, about the drought, which matches very nicely with current scientific evidence. And then one that came out a little earlier, Orson Scott Card's Artifact or Artifice, Where It Stands After 25 Years. Scott Card, the well-known Latter-day Saint science fiction author, Ender's Game and all that sort of thing, wrote a piece 25 years ago in which he looked at the Book of Mormon from the perspective of an experienced professional writer. What would a person like that with that background who writes daily, what would he notice? What would be the telltale signs of fiction or nonfiction? And it was a really interesting original contribution. And so Jeff Lindsay, who's one of our more prolific contributors at the Interpreter Foundation, how he does it from his base in Shanghai, I do not know, but he does it.
It's the time change and the dateline.
So he's always ahead of us.
That's what it is.
So he looks at it and sees how it stands up after 25 years, and his argument is that it stands up very, very well, and he offers some new supporting data that actually strengthens Scott Card's points. And a couple of areas with the work of Stan Carmack and Royal Skousen where maybe Scott Card's approach would have to be modified a little bit, but it actually strengthens his overall case. So that's worth reading. It's a good summary of, I think, where things have been going in Book of Mormon studies in recent years. And then another one, I'm amazed sometimes when I see these things that come out in Interpreter, because I think I would not have thought about that. There was a piece that was done by Ben Jordan and Warren Aston on the geology of Moroni's stone box, examining the setting and resources of Palmyra, concluding that the description of the stone box that is given is geologically plausible for that area. It makes sense that, and in some areas it wouldn't be, but in that particular area it is. So just to, you know, it's not a small thing, or not a big thing. It doesn't prove the Book of Mormon true. But it does mean that that story is plausible, that it makes sense in a way that that it might otherwise not have made sense. And then if you want a Christmas recommendation from me, there are a lot of them. Julie Smith's book, of course, if it were to come out in time, the new biography of Martin Harris, I think is a really interesting
one.
We
talked about that a couple of times ago when I've been on the air.
Larry Porter and Susan Easton Black, that would be an interesting one. There's a biography of W.W. Phelps that's out.
That was my religious book of the year on my radio.
Oh, was it really?
Yes,
okay.
It was. It's because it's the most readable. I mean, I love the scholarship, don't get me wrong, but that one was just so well written and fascinating, and there were so many interesting things about W.W. Phelps. That certainly is one of my recommendations.
Well, that's Bruce Van Orden.
Oh, that's right.
W.W. Phelps. And then one that I just finished actually today, which is by Bruce Hafen, an emeritus member of the 70, First Quorum of the 70, and his wife Marie Hafen. They were earlier president and matron of the St. George Temple. He used to be the provost at BYU, dean of the BYU Law School, president of BYU Idaho. I mean, he's got an amazing background. By the way, I'll just mention parenthetically, one of the funniest things about Bruce, I've known Bruce for years. When he was provost of BYU, no one knew exactly what the word provost meant, and so he launched a competition for the best definition of the word provost, or the office of provost. And the winner, which was announced at the annual university conference in August, was provost. The definition is the person most like provo. So, anyway, but they wrote a book together called Faith Is Not Blind. And it's obviously intended for an audience of especially millennials and so on who might be having a struggle with some of the assaults, the acids eating away at their faith. And so they look at ways to deal with this. What's the approach you should take when confronted with a faith challenge? It's not so much dedicated to specific issues or even a resource list or anything like that. It's general approaches to how you should react. What should be your response when you're hit with something that kind of knocks you for a loop? And it is, as I would have expected it to be, knowing the Hafens, a very wise, very reflective book based on all that experience and also extraordinarily bright minds. And it's not very long. It's 130-something pages long, 131, I think, and a small paperback. So, you know, it's, I think, designed in a way for millennials.
Well, I'm glad you said that, not me.
Yeah, I can say it because I'm a geezer and I can get away with it, you know. but, you know, it's got 11 testimonials in it from people who are almost all in their 20s and 30s. You know, it's plain that they're going for that group and trying to offer them something to help them out. But I liked it quite a bit. I don't know that it would settle everybody's issues or something.
It's about the size of a stocking stuffer, where Julie's, frankly, is one of my favorites. It's called the Cinder Block.
Yes,
version.
You could build a house.
I love cinder blocks. Oh yeah, I do. Bruce Hafen was the president of the St. George Temple for a while, and I was a worker there. And Blaine Jorgensen was working there as well. And they did the All That Was Promised book about the history of the building of the St. George Temple, which is a very good book, and it could not have happened without Bruce's support. I think.
Well, he's a very prolific writer and thinker, and I almost hate to admit it, but I knew him, I think, before my mission or just after. I was on a committee with him where I did not precisely distinguish myself. So I've seldom brought that up to him to remind him that we actually met during an era when I was an undergraduate, but more a goof-off than an undergraduate. And
well, we won't even talk about how far John and I go back, but I'm a little older than John, and I'm a contemporary with his older brother, and we used to visit his family in Wyoming and in California, so... I knew John way back before he was even in middle school, I think. But look what he's turned into now.
Yeah, he's actually turned out more or less reputably.
That's right. Well, Kevin, what are your recommendations for people coming up?
Well, since Christmas is coming up, there's a very good book by Margaret Barker called Christmas, the Original Story, that I'm very fond of. It's a few years old. It came out in 2008, but it's still very fun because she renews the Christmas stories, you know, and this is one of the things I like. And she talks especially about temple symbolism in the Christmas stories. She goes through,
Well, I was just going to say, I like the way in that one that she talks about the sacrifice when they bring Jesus to the temple as an infant, and how, you know, there's actually a particular sacrifice that's not made because Jesus doesn't need it.
Right. This is a comment. She wrapped him in swaddling clothes. It's literally, she wrapped him around. Why mention the baby's clothes? Because the clothing of the newly born high priest was an important part of his becoming the son. Enoch was taken from his earthly garments, his human body, and clothed with the garments of God's glory because he had become part of the glory. The new child is clothed with earthly garments, so the process is reversed. So it's a fairly little book, and it just goes through some of the background and then goes through Luke and Matthew and then also through the infancy gospel of James and some of the Arabic accounts. So it kind of renews the familiar. And then, especially with the infancy gospel of James that I'd first heard about, and Nibley had an essay in Mormonism and Early Christianity where he talked about how sober and realistic that one is. But just kind of to have the Christmas stories renewed in ways, the older I get, the more I like to be renewed. And this is something that I really enjoy.
That's a book that you can find on the Kindle, by the way, if you have trouble finding a copy. I think there's a stray copy kicking around somewhere in Provo, the BYU bookstore maybe, I'm not sure, but
I would guess. Yeah.
Well, I use Bookfinder and Amazon whenever I have to track things down, since I can't get to the BYU library as often as I might like to.
It's not what it used to be, we'll just say that.
Yeah, oh, that's depressing.
Well, the library is
fine, the bookstore I meant.
It's not what it used to be.
Well, they don't even call it the BYU bookstore anymore. It's the BYU store.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Which is,
recognizes
the facts.
Yeah.
Main floor.
Well, it used to be one of the best bookstores I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it was a great bookstore. But bookstores are dying.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when we still drive by where Borders used to be, the Borders bookstore in Utah Valley, I put my hand over my heart. I used to like to just go there and browse.
There were three of them in Las Vegas. I drove by all the time, and their business model was not a good one.
Yeah.
That's why they went under even earlier than many of the others.
But, you know, bookstores are just dying one by one. And I have to admit, I go to Amazon, and so I'm part of the problem. But then I should mention, by the way, there's Amazon Smile. And I want to do a little commercial on that really quickly. At Christmas time, when you're buying books, register for Amazon Smile. The prices are no different, but Amazon pays a certain percentage, half a percentage point, toward a charity of your choice. In other words, it's their money, not yours. And I encourage people to sign up for that, for interpreter, or frankly, if it's not interpreter, something, because you might as well. It costs you literally absolutely nothing to go on Amazon Smile, which is part of the regular Amazon.
Well,
same books, everything else, and then Amazon is giving money to some cause you designate.
Well, and Amazon does sell the bound versions of the Interpreter
they
Journal.
Yeah.
You can get it free online every week, but if you want them bound, you like the paper, just go to Amazon. They sell them all.
Yeah.
So, John?
I love the paper when I can get it.
Yeah, paper's good when you're dealing with deep material, I've often found.
Well, a lot of people, even of the younger generations, if they're reading, prefer to read on paper. So you'd ask for my recommendations. Given this is a sort of New Testament year coming up, one of my recommendations might seem a little strange. It's Craig Evans' Jesus and His Contemporaries. And I recommend this as a book that completely changed the way I thought about a number of facets of the ancient world. It's It's a little bit of a struggle to read, but it's also amazing at presenting the evidence that he goes through in a more accessible format, or at least for as far as scholars go.
That's so one I'll be looking up when we're done here, I can tell you.
And
how does it compare with Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Bauckham?
It's not the same, not dealing with the same book. It's a lot of looking at how Jesus fits in with Jewish interpretations of the Old Testament. And so it's very good that way. Greg Kinnear has a great book on whose name escapes me right now on Jesus as well. And then there's always James Hoffmeyer's Archaeology of the Bible, which covers both the Old and the New Testament and the archaeological evidence behind both of them. It's very readable. It's lavishly illustrated. And it's one that I recommend to a general readership.
We can also recommend another one. I don't remember exactly when it came out, but there is a book that I recommend to everybody, which is John Gee's Introduction to the Book of Abraham.
Yeah. We talked about that last month when we were on the air, but Christmas is coming, and that would be a good one.
Yep.
And it's available at Deseret Book or at Amazon or at Fair Mormon.
That's right. So I guess the choice that I would have is a new one by Elaine Pagels, of all people. And it's called Why Religion.
Yes.
And, you know, the thing about her, years ago, before I started on the radio when I was in Kansas in the military, I was reviewing books, and one of the books I reviewed was Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, which is a bit of a story about the Garden of Eden and how Satan came in and some Gnostic elements from the scriptures and the Nag Hammadis about that. She's a scholar of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I later discovered that she had a child who died of a lung disease, and then a year later, her husband died in a hiking accident.
Yes.
Fell about, I don't know how many feet, 100 feet off a cliff in Colorado or somewhere. And this book that just came out about a month or so ago is her personal story about all that and what religion has come to mean to her as a scholar of religion. But, you know, there's a lot of people out there who write about religion and yet they are not believers. A friend of mine in St. George, Stan McConkie, is the son of Bruce McConkie, and he said that the reason that Bruce, when he wrote The Mortal Messiah, used commentaries that were older was because when he was writing in the 70s, the common academic theme was not to believe. That's different now. I mean, most of the commentaries that I see now are generally written by believers, but that wasn't the case. But for her, she's not really a churchgoer per se, but it's just a fascinating story about how important religion is to people, what it means, why it means, and it's a very personal and close story from a woman who unexpectedly, because I've read her scholarly material, and yet for her to reach out and do something on such a personal and closely held thing in her life was a real good recommendation for me, a very personal one as opposed to some of the other recommendations that I might make. And of course, the ones we've talked about are there too. The the W.W. Phelps, the We'll Sing and We'll Shout.
Mm-hmm.
The additional verses for the Spirit of God that were sung at the dedication of the Kirtland Temple are pretty intriguing for those who have been through the LDS endowment ceremony. So it's just, but that whole. I love reading about people that are imperfect. We'll be right back for the last segment of the program. This is Terry Hutchinson with Dan Peterson, Kevin Christensen, and John Gee. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson on our final segment on Interpreter Radio. We've got Dan Peterson, the head of the Interpreter Foundation, with me in studio, along with John Gee from BYU. We've got Kevin Christensen, an independent scholar from back east somewhere. We don't want to give his exact address. We have to protect his anonymity since he's really J.K. Rowling, according to Dan.
Yeah, he'd be mobbed.
Yes. So, you know, we were just talking off the air for a minute, Kevin, about we've talked a lot about New Testament recommendations because we're all getting excited. This happens to me every year. In August, the New Testament books or the Old Testament books, the next course of study for Sunday school always starts showing up on the bookshelves, and I start getting excited. But I always forget, we've got great stuff still coming out. One of the things that I mentioned to John last week, and I'm really getting excited for, is the release of the full three-volume, 3,500 pages, might be 32, but it's 3,500 pages of the Hebrew Bible translated all by Robert Alter from Cal Berkeley.
Oh. One of my former professors.
Yeah, that release officially is December the 18th. Norton's a little hard. They're being a little harder than normal for me to get a hold of. So I still haven't seen it yet, although, you know, I've got all of the other volumes. And I remember, okay, when is he going to get to Isaiah? When is he going to get to Jeremiah and Ezekiel? This all has it, but it not only has that, it has all the rest. It has the five books of Moses, mm-hmm. It has the historical books he's done, it has the wisdom books he's done and everything, and we've still got some Old Testament to talk about here. Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, what kind of advice have you got for people who are still kind of studying that tail end of the Old Testament between now and the end of the year?
Well, of course, I like the Older Testament by Barker, but when you mentioned Robert Alter, that's The Art of Biblical Narrative is still a remarkable book to read, and that's one of the ones that when I read it, it changed the way that I read, and I could take, you know, it enhanced my appreciation of the Old Testament, plus it was something that I could take into my reading of the Book of Mormon, and it changed the way that I read the Book of Mormon as well. You know, I think it was Alan Goff that kind of pointed me that way, but I've jumped on it and have used it quite a bit. In fact, this latest articles that I've just written, I actually quote some Robert Alter.
It's interesting because Alan Goff is the first person I ever read who used the word hermeneutics. And since somehow that just struck me because he was talking about the Book of Mormon when he used it. Alter's mm-hmm. got a new one coming out in April, by the way, from Princeton, and it is called The Art of Biblical Translation. Now, I understand Princeton University has a series of little short books about translation. I know one of them was written by the translator of Don Quixote that came out a few years ago. It's got a bright red cover. I can't remember her name, but she also has translated. The guy that wrote 100 Years of
Garcia Marquez.
Garcia Marquez, yeah. She was one of his translators. So they've done several of those, and he's got one coming out in April that ought to be really good. The companion volume to the one that Kevin mentioned is The Art of Biblical Poetry, I believe. They kind of go together, mm-hmm. those two. John?
Yes, well, Alter was quite an impressive teacher. He writes very much the way he talks, or maybe we could say that he teaches very much the way he writes, and he thinks things through carefully, and it comes out this wonderful, eloquent prose as he's talking, and he is a master of the Hebrew language and appreciates the nuances of, he also is master of the English language and appreciates the nuances of how do you render something that's in Hebrew into an English that's felicitous that would convey what it does in Hebrew. And he talks about the masterful job that the King James translators did in rendering the Bible and some of the things that their locutions that he's taken over because he says this is truer to the Hebrew than some of the more modern, more paraphrastic translations. That he's finally coming out with the whole thing is an impressive achievement to translate that much material by yourself, but also that he has that sensitivity when he's translating it, that it's not just running roughshod over the text.
Yeah, but he's missed the prophets. I mean, all of the translation he's done up to this point, there was a donut hole, if you will, and this will cover the donut hole, and I just can't wait. I'm excited. So, Dan, what kind of advice have you got for people getting finished with the Old Testament between now and the end of the year?
Read it. I teach gospel doctrine class in my ward. And, you know, it's a good class. We have good discussions. Actually, I tend to lecture. But I think a lot of people are intimidated by the Old Testament, by the Hebrew Bible, and they don't read. That's typical of most of us. So we come to gospel doctrine class. We don't have assignments. There won't be any consequences if you haven't read. There won't be a quiz or a test. You don't get a bad grade. And so quite often we come and we're not prepared really to discuss in any depth because we haven't really read the text. We just remember, like today I taught the stories of Esther, you know, going before King Ahasuerus, or Daniel in the lion's den, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. And I find that people are just, you know, they've heard the stories all their lives since they were in junior Sunday school. And so we're not reading the text. We're just remembering the story that we've always heard. And I'm not trying to criticize my particular ward in specifically, but I just hope people will read, and especially when we get to the New Testament. I mean, there's just really no excuse. It's going to be in smaller bites, and people have to come to class prepared.
Well, I think the other thing about it is we're talking about the actual words of Jesus, which is so important. But my daughter taught today that same lesson that you covered, and rather than focus on the Word of Wisdom story or something else, she talked with her singles ward, you know, the 18 to 30s, about if I perish, I perish. What does that mean? Right. What does it mean in the modern, kind of a follow-up to what you were talking about with the Hafens in terms of if you struggle with something in the church, how do you deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you go forward? What's the difference? I mean, why is it seem so hard for us when we have these people who are willing to risk everything to be obedient? Or like Nephi outside the walls of Jerusalem when he, no matter what the obstacle, continues to go forward to get the brass plates because he's kind of made a covenant and he's got to keep that. That, to me, is where we really get these lessons from the Old Testament, when we can take them from the childhood stories that we've known forever and turn them into something that is meaningful for us in the 21st century.
I tried to emphasize today that these were books that became very popular among Jews during a period when they had lost their autonomy after the Babylonian captivity. And so it's really, the stories are advice to them for the situation that Jews would find themselves in for centuries to come. Where they're in societies that are, on the whole, unfriendly to their beliefs, not supportive of them, not independent, autonomous Jewish states, but under the thumb of the Seleucids or various dynasties that take over, the Romans and so on. This will be their fate until at least 1948, under the Tsar. I mean, look at the Fiddler on the Roof. I mean, I pray that the Tsar may stay far from me, right? So it's meant to encourage people who are living as strangers and foreigners in a society that is not supportive of their beliefs. And I said, you know, you can liken that unto us. We're in a society that is not on the whole supportive of our beliefs and increasingly opposed to them on certain moral issues and so on that finds us ludicrous. I mean, nice but stupid. That's sort of the approach of the Book of Mormon musical. Mormons are earnest but dumb. Certainly not fashionable. So it's good advice for us. But the other thing that struck me about it was today, for some reason, you read the story of Esther when Mordecai tells her the situation, says, look, you need to go talk to the king. And Esther, it's not like Esther says, oh, yeah, absolutely, I'm a religious fanatic, I'll do that right away. Her first reaction is, are you kidding? You know what the rule is, that if I walk into his presence and he doesn't want me there, I die? And then he says, you have an obligation. Don't think that you're going to escape this. The situation is bad for everybody. Who knows but what you were into the come into the kingdom for such a time as this. And so I said, you know, we shouldn't imagine that ancient people lived in a time when, yeah, they were in a minority, but it was easy because they were heroic, and it's tough for me. It was tough for them. So you can liken these scriptures to us.
Well, the other thing I want to bring out, not to minimize any of this, we have a tendency to think, okay, let's get on to the New Testament. We'll just drop the end of the Old Testament. Well, don't forget that the very end of the Old Testament, one of the last things we get is Malachi, which Jesus found so significant that he insisted that the Nephites had to do it.
Yes.
And Moroni quotes it.
Yeah. Yes.
First thing to Joseph Smith, it's section 2 in the Doctrine and Covenants.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only passage that is quoted in all four of our standard works.
Yeah.
And that's how important they thought that the last very tail end is. So don't drop it.
No, I mean, in fact, it strikes me because in the manuscript, or not the in the manuscript, but also the first edition of the Book of Mormon, it's one chapter, not broken up into two chapters like we have it in our today, in our modern version today, and that's exactly the way it is in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah,
there is only three chapters in Malachi, not four.
Yeah, it's an interesting
set of circumstances, but that is true. And then you finish with Elijah, the prophet, and immediately to lead off the New Testament, you get John the Baptist coming in, and he is dressed like Elijah, mm-hmm. as Julie and I were talking about in the previous hour. There's a lot of symbolisms. In fact, Bruce Chilton, along with Daniel Gertner, did a what's called the Comparative Handbook on the Gospel of Mark. You may be familiar with it, where they've taken a lot of they take Old Testament scriptures or Hebrew Bible scriptures. They take pseudepigrapha. They take the Community Rule, Dead Sea Scrolls, lots of other sources, and combine them. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the comments that they make in there. That's a real interesting tool for the Book of Mark. They're working currently on one for Matthew and Luke, mm-hmm. and hopefully they'll get to John. But as you guys know in your academic fields, those books take a long time, and this one's been 10 years already. Yeah. Hopefully we'll see it soon, but you never know.
That's true.
Yeah, there's a real link in the Elijah story. Elijah disappears in the area probably right by where John's baptismal site is. Just
you know,
across.
I hadn't thought of that, but that does make a lot of sense. It's right there at the River Jordan.
Yeah, so when people say, are you Elijah? This is not as crazy as it sounds, because he had disappeared there, and then all of a sudden John the Baptist appears there dressed the same way. And so there's a certain logic to the question.
But the same sort of odd eating habit.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
locusts and wild honey. Yeah,
it was raw honey, so it was healthy.
Yeah, right.
That's right. Organic.
I think. Yeah, there were just no organic stores in the area, but there are some now. I can point out some in Jericho.
Mm. We'll have to go there sometime and see. Anyway, just a quick wrap up here on the interpreter for the last minute or two. Just a note that we're on every Sunday night from 7 to 9. We have a rotating series of hosts, and we want to thank you for listening. This is Terry Hutchinson with Dan Peterson, Kevin Christensen, and John Gee signing off.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks.
Good night.